here. The public health community has been a tremendous partner in helping to improve community design and development, both at a national level with folks like Howard Frumkin, Richard Jackson, Andy Dannenberg, and down to the local community and neighborhood level with people in the public health community just getting involved in development decisions. So I'm very glad to have been invited here and pleased to be here. I also have no relationships to disclose. So I'd like to start off just quickly talking about some of what's going on at the federal level on smart growth and climate adaptation. Of course, the big news on climate adaptation, as Jalone mentioned, is the President's executive order, which is not on my slide and probably not on hers because it was released 2 days after the deadline for us to submit our slides. But essentially what this executive order does is direct federal agencies to identify and remove barriers that might be preventing communities from developing or from building resilience, to reform federal policies and funding programs that might inadvertently be making economic systems, built-in natural systems, more vulnerable to climate change. Finding ways to support and encourage smarter, more climate-resilient investments by states, local communities, and tribes through our various assistance and funding programs, and developing information, data, and tools that can help communities better understand what their climate impacts are and incorporate them into their infrastructure and development decisions. It also establishes a council of federal agencies and then a state, local, and tribal leaders task force that are both going to help inform federal agencies. And if you're interested in having some input into the task force, I urge you to go to the White House website. They've got a list there of all the state, local, and tribal leaders who are involved in that task force. So EPA had developed a climate adaptation strategy like every federal agency did, and the key point for this particular topic is that we are trying to mainstream climate adaptation considerations into all of EPA's work. And on the same day that the President released the Resilience Executive Order, EPA released the implementation plans from its program offices and regional offices that talk about how those offices will actually implement this adaptation strategy. Those are all posted on EPA's website. They're open for public comment now, so if you are perhaps concerned that environmental justice is not getting the attention that it deserves, again, I'd urge you to go look those up and make comments on them. So EPA works a lot with other federal agencies. We're in the Partnership for Sustainable Communities with the Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Department of Transportation. And through this partnership, we try to align our programs and funding to create more housing and transportation options in communities while also protecting the environment and public health and addressing the challenges of climate change. And my office, the Office of Sustainable Communities, coordinates EPA's involvement in the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. We are the home of EPA's Smart Growth Program. We coordinate EPA's green building work. We're non-regulatory. We only go where we're asked to go. We help federal agencies, states, regions, tribes, local governments, anybody who asks for our help with technical assistance, research, tools, publications. And like all of EPA, we're figuring out how to mainstream adaptation into everything that we do and figuring out where the connections are between smart growth strategies and climate adaptation. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page when I'm talking about smart growth, and if you already know what it is, just bear with me. I'll go through this quickly, but essentially it refers to development policies that benefit the environment, public health, the economy, and the community as a whole. It's guided by a set of 10 principles that are flexible enough to be applied in big cities like Boston or in small towns like Howard, South Dakota. So here's what those principles look like in practice. Mixing land uses, up here you can see there's apartments above shops and restaurants down on the ground floor. This brings new life to the street and new amenities to the neighborhood, and it also creates more housing options, which are important to have so that people at different stages of life and with different incomes can live in the same neighborhood. You can see here in the foreground, there are townhouses, then right behind there's a street of single-family homes. So when someone who lives in those the single-family homes their child grows up, wants to live close to their parents but have a place of their own, they've got options. And likewise, when the parents decide they want to downsize to a more manageable place, maybe they can find a condo or an apartment or a townhouse and stay in the same neighborhood where they've built those relationships. Having walkable neighborhoods, meaning you've got interesting, safe, attractive streets that make it pleasant and comfortable to walk or to bike. Again, you have the mix of uses that draws people out, that gives them places to walk to, and giving them the transportation choices like walking, biking, or public transit in addition to driving makes it easier for people who cannot or choose not to drive to get around. It also gives people who might have a car some more affordable transportation options as well. Of course, you get the public health benefits of having the regular physical activity from walking and biking, and reducing the number of cars on the road reduces injuries and deaths from accidents as well as illnesses from air pollution. And all these things are easier to do if you develop compactly so that you've got the mix of uses and the transportation options and the housing options close enough together that you can walk or bike. You've got the density of people to support public transit and to support a variety of shops and services. And if you do choose to drive, you can drive shorter distances. So if you develop compactly, it's easier to direct development to existing communities, which takes advantage of previous investments in infrastructure. It takes development pressure off of open space, which makes it easier to preserve land, including farmland, which helps you have fresh, locally grown food nearby, and open natural areas that perform vital ecological functions like protecting water supplies. And green spaces, of course, also have mental health benefits like alleviating depression and reducing stress. Engaging stakeholders helps ensure that development decisions meet the community's needs and address their concerns. And it can also help build a sense of community, as can developing communities with a strong sense of place and preserving the things that really make them distinctive. This builds a sense of social capital, which is particularly important when we start talking about climate resilience. And when you have ground rules that are clear to everyone, it's predictable and fair, that attracts developers, and it lets current residents know what kind of new development they can expect. So we hear some of the same challenges come up over and over again when we're talking about climate adaptation, that communities or some leaders in communities feel like they're overwhelmed by the information out there. They feel like some of the projections are maybe uncertain. They've got a lot of competing priorities for a very limited budget, and they can find it difficult to justify spending money on something that the community might not see the benefit for years or maybe even decades into the future. So smart growth strategies could help overcome some of those obstacles. For one thing, they bring benefits regardless of the amount of climate change that happens. That helps reduce some of the issues with uncertainty. They save individuals money by giving them transportation options, encouraging more energy efficient homes, which reduces energy bills. And they are fiscally responsible for local governments because compact development uses resources and public investment more efficiently. And finally, you can integrate smart growth considerations and with them adaptation considerations into regular updates of zoning codes and building codes. So you can make incremental progress every time those codes are updated, and most places require them to be updated within certain periods. It might be 3 years or 5 years. But then it also helps make sure that as you're developing an adaptation strategy, it's also aligning with your community's development goals. So as we've been thinking in my office about how to align what we do on smart growth with climate adaptation, we came up with these sort of broad principles just informally. We want to have strategies that are no or low regrets so that they'll bring benefits regardless of the amount of climate change that happens, and they'll bring benefits over the short and long terms and multiple benefits because we know we can't afford to spend money on a solution that fixes only one problem and accomplishes only one goal. We want strategies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions in addition to helping communities adapt to climate change so that we're reducing our long-term vulnerability. Climate change brings economic uncertainty and change, and we want to help communities become more economically diverse and flexible. And of course, climate impacts will hit certain people harder than others, the very young, the very old, people with low incomes, people who don't speak English, chronically ill people, overburdened and minority communities. And so we want to make sure that any strategies that are implemented both protect and benefit those populations as well. So I'm going to talk just quickly about these sort of four broad categories of smart growth strategies that can help with climate adaptation. One of the first steps when a community plans its growth is to figure out where it makes sense to build and where it doesn't make sense. And most places have some kind of restriction on developing in floodplains, for example. But as the climate changes, they'll need to determine if their development restrictions need to change because the floodplain might be changing, wildfire hazard zones might expand. And many places support development with public resources in some way, whether it's through financial or regulatory incentives, paying for infrastructure or services, rescuing people in case of an emergency, or helping to rebuild after a disaster. So some communities are starting to rethink if they really want to keep putting their public money into places where it's currently hazardous or projected to be hazardous. So you don't need to just completely abandon these places. There are uses that are appropriate for areas that are hazardous, maybe for homes or businesses. This picture is from Charles City, Iowa. This is along the Cedar River, which floods repeatedly, and eventually FEMA bought out the properties along the river, and the city used the buyout properties to create this park. So when the river floods, as it always does, the green space absorbs the water, keeps it from flooding the homes and businesses in town. And then you can even see this slide that the kids are going down is actually part of the stormwater management system. So there's ways to make it attractive and to make it useful in everyday life while preparing for emergencies. So where it does make sense to grow, obviously grow compactly, have a mix of uses, as I discussed. One of the key things that I want to make sure I mention is that market research has shown over many years that people want to live in these places. Consistently, about a third of home buyers and about 75% of renters want to live in mixed-use walkable communities. There are not enough homes in those communities to meet the demand right now. So we need to build more of those places, and people want the options and they're not available right now. So the mix of uses helps improve quality of life every day by having all the jobs and services and amenities within easy reach. But it can also be helpful in an emergency because these civic places, like libraries or schools, can be emergency shelters in case of a heat wave or a powerful storm. And then they can also be focal points for community recovery. They can be a powerful symbol that the community is coming back. The New York Times architecture critic Michael Kimmelman had an article probably about a month ago called something like Next Time Libraries Could Be Our Shelter from the Storm that talks about this. I really encourage you to check that out. So building water and energy efficient buildings and neighborhoods helps us conserve resources that are already strained and are likely to become more strained in many parts of the country as drought and heat waves increase. Again, they can save people money on water and energy bills, and that's particularly important for low-income people. If someone doesn't have a lot of money and there's a heat wave and they're afraid to turn on the air conditioner because it's going to double or triple their electric bill, having an energy-efficient air conditioner and a well-insulated home could literally be the difference between life and death for them. And Adele mentioned passive survivability, which is something we've just been looking into, and this is, again, making sure the building's habitable without, if it loses external power. So this is the Langston Brown Community Center in Arlington, Virginia. And it's got windows that open to provide ventilation. It's got those shades over the windows to keep the sun out at the hottest part of the day. And behind that white screen, there's a huge cistern that collects rainwater that can then be used for potable or non-potable use. So I talked already about the importance of making walking and biking safe and appealing, and one way to do that is to build green, complete streets. These are streets that are safe and comfortable for everyone who uses them, and they have these green features. You can see in the upper photo there, there's a little planted area, and This is a street in Edmundston, Maryland that used to have a lot of problems with flooding. Now when it rains, the water flows into the planted area up there. That planted area absorbs some of the water, filters out some of it, slows it down. When it comes out through that curb cut and flows into the storm sewer, it's moving more slowly, there's less of it, and it's cleaner. Again, the walking and biking is a great way to get people to incorporate that recommended daily amount of exercise into their daily routines, which a lot of Americans don't meet that goal. It can help people get to medical care, again, particularly important for people who can't afford or don't want to drive. And walkable communities have been shown in research to have higher levels of social capital and social cohesion, which is tremendously important when you're talking about preparing for, getting through, and recovering from a disaster. I'll just quickly go through some of the tools and resources that my office has available. We put out this publication with EPA's Office of Environmental Justice called Creating Equitable, Healthy, and Sustainable Communities. It's got specific strategies that communities can use to help improve low-income, minority, and overburdened communities. Our built-in natural environments is a great resource. EPA had put out this report back in 2001 that really was the first thing to pull together all the research on how development patterns affect human health and the environment. Obviously, there's been a lot more research since then, so we just updated it. It's a tremendous compilation of research, not only on how development affects health and the environment, but also how certain development patterns, like compact development and transit-oriented development, can be better for the environment and human health. And then hopefully by the end of next week, we'll release our office's first publication that relates to climate adaptation. This is a result of a technical assistance project that we did with the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments in the D.C. region, and that's got specific smart growth strategies that communities can use to prepare for and adapt to climate change. We have a number of technical assistance programs. The Greening America's Capitals is one that's specifically for state capital cities. We have reports from those available, and those deal mainly with green infrastructure and green streets. There's a lot of great design ideas in those. Our Smart Growth Implementation Assistance is more in-depth research and assistance on cutting-edge issues. We have reports from those on a huge range of issues. The Building Blocks for Sustainable Communities is a targeted one-day workshop on a variety of different tools, and we'll actually have a call for applications for that, hopefully coming out in February, depending on our budget. And there are several that are relevant to public health. You can see I won't read the list, it'll be up on our website. One of the things that we do through that program is as we deliver these different tools, we refine them, and when we think that they're at a good enough point, we'll turn them into workbooks that will be on our website, available to anybody to just pick up and be able to deliver that tool to a community. The only one that's made it to that point so far is this walkability workbook, and that gives you everything that you need to conduct a workshop in your community on walkability and to conduct walkability audits. And then if you like data, there's this Sustainable Communities Hot Report where you can plug in your county and you can get these indicators on a whole variety of topics. You can look at trends over time and you can compare your community to other places that you think are similar. So there's my contact information. And one last plug is for the New Partners for Smart Growth Conference, which is in Denver in February. We have always had a terrific contingent of public health people come to that conference every year. So if you're interested at all in the topic of smart growth, I urge you to consider attending. Thank you.